Hi everyone, my name is Eugenia Chow and I run the Instagram account Ugreenia. The Everyday Activist podcast is founded under the belief that there's no one-size-fits-all approach to activism and anyone can get involved. EA Bako, also known as EA Loves Life on Instagram, is an educator originally from Nigeria but currently based in the United States. As a strong advocate for racial equity and animal rights, and a firm believer that knowledge is power, she uses her platform to write about veganism, interconnected oppression, and collective liberation. In this episode, we discuss why veganism needs to be anti-capitalist, the connection between animal, female, and black liberation, structures that prevent veganism from being as effective as we'd like, and how everyone can contribute to dismantling these power structures to attain food justice. Hi, EA, and welcome to this episode of the Everyday Activist podcast. I'm always so inspired by the content that you put out on Instagram, and so I'm really excited to talk to you today and learn more about your views on veganism and oppression and everything that you have to share. So firstly, could you please tell us a bit about your background? What inspired you to become vegan in the first place, and how would you describe your work?
Absolutely. So I'm originally from Nigeria, and I moved to the United States with my family when I was 2 years old. So in our culture, we actually eat mostly plant-based, especially where my family is from, in the Middle Belt region of Nigeria, which is called Kogi State. But my parents, them not growing up in affluence, they always look forward to a time when they consider being able to eat meat a form of abundance and a luxury. When we moved to the United States and that was a possibility for our family, you know, I grew up raised in a meat eating household and I just considered that to be normal. I don't have many memories of growing up in Nigeria and specifically the types of traditional plant-based cuisine that my family used to cook. So I was raised primarily on an American diet with some Nigerian food here and there. But I decided to go on this journey of going vegan shortly after my father was diagnosed with stage 4 liver cancer. He had surgery to remove the tumor. And during the surgery, he lost so much blood that we almost lost him. And that was like a wake-up call in my life, just about the fact of how precious life is and how temporary it is to have people that you love in your life. But thankfully, you know, through treatment and, you know, the amazing doctors, you know, my dad's still here with us. You know, he's still battling, but he's doing extremely well. And I tell this story because this is just one of the instances in my life that just woke me up to having more empathy for all living beings, not just human beings. But I think that a lot of times vegans start their story with, I watched a documentary and then I went vegan. But there's so many stepping stones before that happened, I think, that we need to talk about. What ended up happening after that, you know, life-changing experience is that I did start taking health more seriously. And I found the documentary Forks Over Knives. And that was my first time hearing that our diet has such a great impact on our life and our longevity. You know, I kind of knew it generally, but it's never what they talk to you about at a typical doctor's visit. You know, they say exercise, drink water, and eat healthy. But what does eat healthy mean? It means something different to everyone. So I learned that, you know, we can reduce our chance of developing cancer and other chronic diseases by eating a plant-based diet. So I went plant-based first and I felt amazing. And then I wanted to know more about what veganism was. So I researched it on YouTube and I watched, you know, the typical explanations on like backyard chickens, eggs, and the video Dairy is Scary. And I learned about the horror of the dairy industry. And then eventually ended up watching Earthlings. And that's when I made the decision to go vegan right away.
What would you say are some of the biggest misconceptions when it comes to going vegan or veganism in general?
I think the first misconception is that it's a movement that's for the elite, for the few who have class privilege to be able to afford a vegan diet. And I would say that to an extent that it is true, but it has a lot of caveats and nuances to it. So not everybody can, you know, go vegan because of limited resources, but this isn't a lifestyle for the privileged elite. You know, beans, rice, starches, grains, those are our most healthy and abundant foods, which are typically the cheapest foods to eat. And make up the basis of most of our vegan meals, especially when we try to eat whole food plant-based. And rice is one of the most eaten foods, you know, across the world. So people in other countries outside of the global north are already eating, these types of foods. People living in the global south are eating majority plant-based foods. And that's something that we need to talk about a lot more, is the fact that a lot of cultures from around the world have been eating, you know, plant-based for hundreds, if not, you know, thousands of years. It's vegan foods are a staple, and it's not a white movement. I see from a lot of, you know, people of color and Black people that they feel excluded from this movement because they don't see enough representation. And what I'm finding out is that here in the United States where I live, the African American community is the largest growing demographic of vegans here. So we are catching on to the fact that this movement is absolutely for everyone. You know, there are exceptions where, you know, people have limitations based upon their health and allergies and you know, accessibility and affordability that make it a challenge. But overall, this is a movement that is inclusive of everyone with different needs.
Would you say there are certain things that people say or do that is hurting the movement more than helping it?
Absolutely. I think that the main thing I'm seeing is this trend of veganism is for the animals only, and that we need to stop talking about racism, sexism, heterosexism, ableism, and all those other forms of oppression, and stop making it political, and stop talking about capitalism and patriarchy. I think those types of caveats in terms of excluding talk about other forms of oppression are really hurting the movement, because you can't have a movement for the animals only when humans are also animals. We just happen to be, you know, human beings, and then other animals are, you know, non-humans, but we still are from the same animal kingdom. And we have to respect human rights as well as animal rights, because while we're focusing on non-human animal rights, this is a human led and run movement. And you can't invite someone into a space and tell them you're not going to be respected here because of your skin color, your sexuality, your gender identity, your disability. We have to make it an inclusive movement that recognizes that people cannot leave their oppression at home and advocate for the animals, that we have to speak in a type of way that includes all people and doesn't discriminate against them, you know, recognizes people's gender pronouns, recognizes that people experience discrimination for the way that they look and the types of abilities they have, you know, and understand that the movement needs to think about things like activists who go to protests, they might need to use a wheelchair. And we have to think about, you know, ways that people are limited from joining this movement because we don't consider that they have oppressions outside of just thinking about animals only.
Yeah, and I think that's something that you do really well on your page, is really laying out the interconnectedness of all these different forms of oppression, and also explaining to people why you can't be a single issue vegan and why you can't only care about one of these issues without really understanding the full picture. So I guess going into that, could you explain how animal liberation, female liberation, Black liberation are interconnected? And what does meat eating have to do with sexism, racism, ableism, and all these other forms of oppression?
Yeah, that's such a really good question. And it's so convoluted. But I mean, to boil it down really is the fact that speciesism is the form of violence that we perpetuate against non-human animals because we discriminate against them because they're different from us. And discriminating against another being because of their difference is basically the root of all forms of oppression. So, you know, the way that we discriminate against, you know, our Black and brown brothers and sisters is because of the color of their skin. And we call that form of discrimination racism. And the way we discriminate against, you know, females is in the form of sexism and also the patriarchy. And what we have to recognize when we speak about interconnected oppression is that animals are not only exploited and marginalized and treated as other because they're a different, you know, form of life than human beings, but they're also exploited and marginalized because of the very similar oppressions that humans face. So take, for example, dairy cows. The female reproductive system is exploited in the dairy industry. And that's also an issue for women's rights. So we have to think about the fact that, you know, animals in general, both male and female, are being discriminated against and exploited because of their reproductive cycle and being used to create products for human beings. And that's something that I feel like the vegan movement can take into consideration, that we don't necessarily need to tokenize other movements and say, hey, come join us because we have similar issues. But we can actually join those other movements and say, we're going to speak up for all women, both human and non-human. We're going to be at the next Women's March and we're going to speak up for human women. But we also want women who are advocating for women's rights to join the vegan movement and advocate for non-humans, and in that way make it consistent. So there's multiple ways that these issues overlap. And I'll bring up another point, which is disability. Humans actually breed disabilities into non-human animals to exploit them. For example, in sheep, they have selectively bred them so much to produce extra wool that they can't shed naturally on their own without, you know, humans to shear them. And so we discriminate against disabled human beings, but we also, you know, force disabilities on other species of animals. So we can collaborate on the issue of disability, even though, you know, we discriminate against non-humans and humans in different ways, but at the core is ableism. So there's multiple ways in which all these forms of oppression interconnect. And what the vegan movement needs to do is we can speak up about all of those individual issues while not forgetting the non-human animals, which is the focus and core of our movement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you talked about how all of these issues overlap and all forms of oppression have to be addressed with an intersectional lens. So what do you say is the root of these injustices and how do we address it from the core?
Well, I think that's a challenging question because I don't think it's one thing. I honestly believe that the way that that oppression is connected is that it's kind of like the medieval chainmetal. It's linked up. You can't just pull out one piece and say that that's going to dismantle the entire thing. I think the way that it works is that we have to speak up individually on all of the issues. But the main ones that we could really focus on are capitalism, colonialism, and the patriarchy. Those issues are really broad and overarching and affect all of the other forms of oppression as well. It's kind of like those in a way are like the umbrella, because and a lot of times in the vegan movement, you'll see people saying like, well, if we eat a plant-based diet, you know, we're using so many resources in animal agriculture to produce food to feed farm animals. So say, for example, we eat a plant-based diet, all of those resources can be redistributed to humans. Well, under capitalism, it's not the case that just because there's an abundance of something, it's going to be evenly distributed. So going vegan does not change the supply and demand model, and it doesn't mean that food gets to where it needs to be. So even in a quote unquote, you know, vegan world, there's still going to be exploitation. There's still going to be poor and marginalized individuals because capitalism makes it impossible for everyone to be treated equally because someone has to get underpaid in order for the money to get funneled to the top into the elite class in order to keep the system of capitalism going.
Yeah, I think a lot of us, by going vegan or reducing our meat consumption, we like to think that, you know, there are those calculators that show us, oh, we saved this many cows by going vegan for a year, or we saved this much water, or like reduced this much CO2. But I think, as you mentioned, it's a lot more complicated than that. And one person going vegan isn't going to be able to change the way that the system operates. So what do you think are some structures in place that don't make veganism as effective as we would like it to be?
I would say like the main one really is capitalism. And I'll go into examples of in the United States. A lot of times we'll see the main celebrity vegans saying that all you need to do is switch your plant milk switch your dairy cow's milk to plant milk and create enough demand for plant milk. And suddenly, you know, dairy farms will cease to exist because everybody will be putting their money towards the product that is going to end up being produced, and then the other one will just, you know, become defunct and not no longer used. Well, unfortunately, here in the United States, the federal government has an agreement with the animal agriculture lobby, which means that regardless of how much money they lose and how much this the demand goes down for dairy, they have gap insurance, which means that from our taxpaying dollars, we're going to pay the difference between what got produced but didn't get demanded. So the shortfall, we're going to pay that with our federal tax money and make sure that the dairy industry does not lose a single penny. So our consumer effort to purchase more ethically is pretty much washed out by the fact that our taxpaying dollars go towards that gap insurance and also towards federal subsidies, which basically just pay them for overproducing.
Do you know why they decide to pull the meat industry specifically?
I think because the meat industry here in the United States has a very powerful lobbying arm. They pay the congressmen and the senators in order to maintain their business. A lot of it has to do with white supremacy and the patriarchy, because the farming actually started as a form of colonization. So basically using animals to, grab hold of land was a tactic used by, colonialist imperialists to wipe out the Native American populations here in the United States and elsewhere, because they could say that this, grazing land, belonged to this cattle here, and then they would push them further and further off their land. And those farmers throughout centuries have never wanted to lose power, and they have passed the land down to their children and their children's children. And then, when lobbying became, a way to influence the government, they've taken on lobbying as a form of maintaining power and maintaining that power structure of always, being able to stay in business. And they're never going to want to give that up until we come up with a counter strategy. And part of that is lobbying against the animal agriculture industry. And we do have, an organization that's already doing that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think you've sort of touched on this, but to anyone who feels, I guess, helpless by the fact that the veganism isn't going to be able to change the way the food industry operates, what would you suggest they do to take their activism a step further?
Absolutely. And I find that when people learn that their activism in terms of, their consumer purchases aren't making as big as a difference as they would like, they do get demoralized and feel hopeless. And there is a waiting period between learning that information and then feeling empowered. And what I encourage people to do is to feel empowered right away. Know that knowledge is power, and it's okay to lean into being confused and not having all the answers. Having questions is the best way to build a new blueprint for the world that we want to see. If we just sit back in our despair and not think about, well, what's the next step? We're gonna get lost, and we're gonna lose hold of this movement. So I encourage people to look into organizations that are being most effective and most strategic. Where I see that happening a lot right now, and one of the best examples I see, is an organization called the Vegan Justice League, and that's the lobbying arm that I was talking about. That is going to Washington with lobbyists to lobby against the animal agriculture industry. But not only that, one of their main projects is helping animal agriculture farmers switch their business model over to plant farming. And I think that's the way of the future. And I also think the other thing is just learning about not only animal rights, but learning about other movements and how other movements were successful. I think when you're armed with information about what people are doing in other movements, and even, like I said, the most effective organizations in animal rights, it gives you a lot of hope, and you find community of people who are doing this the right way. I also see another example called A Well-Fed World. One of the projects they do is they give grants to small organizations. A lot of them are grassroots. And I think grassroots is also the way of future activism and not corporate organizations, but they help them spread the message in their communities. So I think instead of thinking that you're powerless because you're just an individual, lean into the fact that there's so many community-oriented projects that you can do that make a direct impact on people's lives.
Yeah, for sure. What does having or achieving food justice as a society look like to you?
To me, the end goal is that everybody should be able to eat healthy plant-based foods, like, you know, regardless of your race or social class, everybody should be able to have access. And we should also think about food sovereignty. So here in the United States, up until the 1930s, post-slavery, the number of African-American farmers was equal to the population of African-Americans. So say, for example, it was approximately 13% of the population was African-American. That was an equal amount of farmers that were represented in the farming industry up until 1930s. But what ended up happening is that because, you know, white supremacist farmers did not like to see, you know, African-Americans coming up post-slavery, they made it harder and harder to get loans to, you know, keep up their farms until their farms went into foreclosure. So nowadays you'll see, you know, 1 to 2% of farmers are Black and or African-American here in the United States. So what I see for food justice is I want to see diverse farmers of all ethnic backgrounds, you know, having land and having the ability to, you know, develop that land through, you know, plant agriculture. And I think that we can get closer to that if we start speaking up about it and start speaking to farmers and helping them transition their businesses over and start helping people of color get loans to develop farms. And especially we need to do this soon because a lot of the, you know, the ancient knowledge of, you know, regenerating the land and taking care of the land is fading out the longer we, you know, wait and just hope that the government will take care of things.
So recently there's been a huge surge of fake processed meats or alternative protein as a way to help people transition to a more plant-based diet. But I see restaurants such as KFC introducing like a vegan version of chicken. It makes me question whether or not they're co-opting this movement for profit and also just ultimately contributing to the same extractive food system that is rife with injustices. So I was wondering, what is your opinion on this? And do you think this is the way to move forward as well in terms of encouraging more plant-based eating?
So this is a very complicated answer. And I can't say that my answer is the right one and other people's answer is the wrong one. But in my opinion, I think that more plant-based options is always a good thing. But we do have to think about, you know, food economy and the way that things are grown and being produced. Even under a plant-based food system, there are ways to still, you know, specifically overproduce specific types of crops. And a lot of, you know, vegan products are based on, you know, soy and wheat and, you know, those products that are very, very heavily farmed and take up a lot of land and water and resources in the sense that they're monocrops. So we do need to think about the fact that, you know, we might just switch from, you know, growing, you know, lots of wheat and stuff like that for animal feed to growing all of a sudden a ton of peas. And what they're saying right now from an environmental perspective is that the best way to regenerate the land is with crop rotation and, you know, having a variety of different types of plants being grown according to the environment that's most suitable for those types of crops. So there is a danger in promoting, you know, this the latest and greatest new vegan product because technically we don't need to be eating, you know, the latest and greatest new vegan product. Like I stated earlier, you know, plant foods have been commonly eaten by people all around the world for, you know, centuries. So we need to go back to eating locally and finding out what crops are abundant and what crops are natural for the areas that we live in. But at the same time too, we do need to have more plant-based options that are easily affordable and accessible, but that's not to say that these fast food restaurants have our best interests in mind when they're producing them because they absolutely do not. And they're investing our profit from buying from them into more animal agriculture. So they're not making a sustainable, just food system for anyone. So I personally don't like to give them my money. I know other vegans do. And I think that we shouldn't police other vegans on what they eat, but we should raise awareness to the fact that these companies are not benefiting our cause, and they are, in a sense, co-opting our cause.
I guess that leads me to the next question, which is, what are your thoughts on the idea of voting with your dollar? And to what extent do you think being a conscious or quote-unquote ethical consumer is an effective solution or approach to achieving animal liberation?
Well, first of all, I think that the concept of voting with our dollar only goes so far because we're in a capitalist system where a lot of our good deeds are really, you know, washed out by, you know, the elite, you know, ruling class, and in the sense they're going to subsidize the industries that they want to succeed, and they're not going to benefit the industries they don't want to see succeeding. So we still need to vote with our dollar, because I believe with great, you know, power and privilege comes great responsibility. So if you're in a position where you can purchase ethically, you have a responsibility and a duty to do so, because the products that we are buying have an impact to people in lower income communities. So for example, you know, we're hearing a lot about environmental racism, and animal agriculture is one of the worst offenders of environmental racism, because the concentrated animal feeding operations are located mostly in poor, brown, rural, and low-income communities. So why would you want to buy a product that's directly contributing to, preventing people from having good health, you know, outcomes, because we're putting all sorts of toxins in the air when we're buying, you know, hamburgers and cheese and all those types of meat products. So I think it's important for people who have the ability to choose more ethically to do that and not be a part of the problem. So even if your purchase is not bailing out the entire system, you still need to think consciously about, well, if you can't do everything, you at least need to do something. And I think that's what's going to move us forward.
So in your opinion, is there such thing as ethical consumption within an oppressive capitalist system?
I think there is to a degree, but not entirely. Every single product that's produced in our society, it capitalizes off of someone else, because even if the product, say, for example, was, made by, you know, a small Etsy company, you know, an individual who's, you know, crafting something, the materials likely came from an exploited worker in Indonesia or China or elsewhere, who was not paid a fair wage for, you know, the base materials that were used to produce that product. So while you may be, you know, helping, you know, a small business owner and their family, and, you know, they were not exploited to make the product, it's likely that the person who helped create the materials was exploited. So that's just one example, but you could just think of any type of consumer good or product. At the end of the day, it links back to somebody who they exploited for the raw materials. So even though you can't have 100% perfect, ethical goods, especially when you live in a city and you live outside your natural ecosystem, I still think you have to make more ethical choices. Because if you're going to advocate for a more peaceful and a more green world, you actually have to be the one who takes the first step. No one's going to listen to you if you don't at least try to lead the lifestyle that you want to see in this world. So I think it's just a matter of, you know, setting the example, but also being realistic and telling people the truth that while their choices don't have as big as an impact as we'd like to see, that's the world that we were working towards. And we have to start by taking the first step.
Yeah. So how do you integrate these different practices or ideals into your own lifestyle and into the way that you make purchases specifically for food?
Well, specifically for food, obviously I'm vegan, so I buy 100% plant-based. But I learn about, you know, companies that, what their ethics are when I make my purchases. So for example, one company that, you know, I don't personally support, but I know other vegans do, is Ben & Jerry's, because even though they have, you know, vegan products, and they've done, you know, great work in terms of advocating and using their voice for Black Lives Matter movement, they're also exploiting people in Israel. I'm not sure a lot of people know about this, but in Palestine, they're part of basically they sell an occupied territory in Palestine, which the human rights organizations all around the world have said that they should stop selling there, and they've refused to stop selling there. So I don't support Ben and Jerry's because I don't support, like, you know, the occupation going on there. But that's just like one example. You know, in terms of like other companies that are vegan, but their practices aren't so good, we're hearing a lot about No Evil Foods. And this is an organization that is against their employees forming unions. And so even though they claim to be very ethical in terms of the products they produce, they're abusing their employees. So I don't support them either. So I don't expect everybody to know everything about every single company when they go out to make their food purchases, but I say be a little bit more mindful and pay attention to the information that you're reading online and take that into consideration when you go shopping.
So for you, what is your main source of information when it comes to learning about different companies and their practices and whether or not they are relatively ethical?
I mainly just do the research. So there's companies that I buy from, and then I'll just go and do a Google search and read their website and what they're saying. And then some of the time you'll find, you know, news stories about these companies just through the mainstream media. Not all the time, but I find that Mother Jones or Huffington Post and Washington Post from time to time will post about, you know, corporations and what their practices are. But I think you just really have to take your products home and research them, or especially even researching them before you go out and buy them. You know, try to stick to, you know, whole food, plant-based as much as possible. But at the end of the day, even for our produce, farm workers are extremely exploited for that. So I follow up with organizations like Food Empowerment Project, and they do a lot of work in terms of amplifying the voices of farm workers and, you know, telling us what they need. So they've done like school, you know, book drives and stuff like that for all sorts of items that their children would need when going back to school. You know, they've told us about the exploitative practices of Driscoll's Berries and then told us to boycott Driscoll's Berries. So I would say follow up with Food Empowerment Project on Instagram and on their website. They've named a lot of companies who are not as ethical as, you know, they could be.
So I think on your page, you've talked about how approaches to animal activism that are taken by organizations such as Anonymous for the Voiceless in a way perpetuate white veganism and other forms of oppression. Could you firstly explain what you mean by white veganism and what are your views on these different approaches to animal activism?
So white vegan veganism is sort of a convoluted term because it does need to be like drilled down to the roots of what it really means. So white veganism does not mean necessarily that your skin is white. And that's the part that for a lot of people, they just hear white veganism and they shut off. But it is rooted in white supremacy. But anybody of any skin color can perpetuate white supremacy. You don't necessarily need to be a white person in order to do that. You just need to perpetuate the ideology and the power structures that are included in white supremacy. So what I mean by that is white veganism is a form of veganism that does not take into consideration other forms of oppression. And it also attempts to depoliticize the movement. And you'll also see a lot of the slogan "for the animals only." And it also takes a right-wing approach. They attempt to say that they're neutral, but what any organization means by they take a neutral approach is that they support the side of the oppressor. And that's been stated throughout history. That's not something that I came up with. But a neutral position always benefits the side of the oppressor. That's just the way the world works. And we need to continue, you know, promoting veganism as a political movement, because there's so many, because food is political. The way that the food system works, like I've described previously, it's all run through politics and policies that decide who gets the most access to food and who doesn't get access to food, who produces food, etc. So, you know, white veganism, they specifically talk about veganism through a lens of, you know, a cis, het, white male. And that's not to say that women don't practice it either. It's just to say that they look at it from the angle of who's the least oppressed person in the world, in a sense, and the type of messaging they bring about comes from that perspective. And I can give, you know, further examples of that. So basically under white veganism, you're going to see a lot of those, like, the educational outreach that AV does, where they're on the street and they're talking to people and they'll be speaking to a Black woman, for example, and then they'll make a video of that exchange and then they'll put it on YouTube and it'll be like Black woman versus vegan activist. And they say they're an apolitical movement, but they basically just marginalize someone's identity even further and kind of made it seem like maybe Black women are in opposition to veganism because of the way they worded that, the headline of that video. And a lot of times you'll see that they put a lot of minorities down. They don't recognize, people's oppressions in terms of they've said in the past things like they're not going to talk about gender pronouns for people who are non-binary or part of the trans community. And those things are vital and crucial for a lot of people, because when you don't recognize somebody for their humanity and for their gender pronouns, they're further marginalizing them. And a lot of people have, you know, even up to taking their lives for feeling like they're not included in society. So we have to be really mindful about how we treat other human beings while we advocate for the animals. So the AV approach, the reason why I've spoken up about it in the past is because they claim to, you know, speak up only for the animals, but while they're doing that, they further marginalize other human beings. They specifically said things like they don't support an interconnected or intersectional approach to activism. And they've also not spoken up at all about Black Lives Matter, and they don't see the connection between Black lives and animal oppression.
So veganism is, I'd say, ultimately rooted in compassion for people, animals, and the planet. So how do you think we can maintain this compassion towards others and ourselves while dismantling, which is a very anger-driven act, to capitalism and all the other structures that maintain these forms of oppression?
So maintaining our compassion while in like a very, I don't really like to call like dismantling, like anger driven or anything like that. I think actually dismantling oppressive systems is a form of love in and of itself, because you want to create a world where people are more closely connected. And I would say that, you know, with compassion, it hurts to feel compassion for so many issues, because when you feel compassion for so many issues, you also feel, you know, responsible for everything that's going on in the world, and you feel obligated to take on the suffering of others. So what I think we need to do is just grow strong enough to have empathy for multiple issues. And we do that through, you know, working with other movements and just reflecting on the fact that we are a community. The vegan movement, you know, we have our disagreements, but we are a community, so we need to lean into each other. I think that what gets people, disconnected and feeling like their compassion is not enough is because we're under patriarchy and capitalism. You know, we're forced to believe that we're individuals, but what's gotten the human race forward as far as we are right now has always been collaboration and working together. So I think that that's what needs to come back, is understanding that, you know, we are a very connected species, and then working together is going to be the best step that we can take to overcome these oppressive power structures. We need to lean into mutual aid and providing for our own local communities, like grassroots activism, similar to what, you know, Columbus Veg Community that I'm a part of locally. And also I'm a part of Plant the Power 614, which is, a Black woman run plant powered organization. So lean into forms of local activism that connect you to your community. And those are ways to lovingly dismantle the system. We interrupt the system by working together collaboratively.
So what is something that excites you about the future, or something that you see happening that excites you?
Well, the thing I'm most excited about now is the fact that I'm seeing so many people learning about interconnected oppression, you know, total liberation, and the fact that, you know, through the aftermath, unfortunately, of George Floyd's, you know, brutal murder, people are waking up to anti-racism. And this is the first time in the animal rights movement, since I've only been involved in it approximately 3 years, that I'm seeing all of these huge vegan organizations talking about Black Lives Matter and seeing them talk about, you know, vegan activists of color and, you know, vegan activists of different, you know, gender orientations and it's gender and sexual orientations. But that makes me really excited to see that representation is becoming really important. We know we need to be a little bit careful that it's not tokenism, because I have seen examples of that too. But I've seen some organizations that have kept up the momentum over the last few months and kept talking about how Black Lives Matter and kept talking about interconnected oppression and have been following, you know, vegans of diverse backgrounds and leaning into getting resources from us and learning about our experiences and how we can contribute to the broader movement. And that, to me, is the most exciting thing. I want to see more of that. I want to see Indigenous voices being amplified, more Black voices being amplified, you know, Indian voices, Chinese voices, Taiwanese voices, people from every single community all around the world. I want to know what the vegan movement is like in their area, and I want to see it amplified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. So also building on that, what does being an activist mean to you?
To me, being an activist is very simple. I shied away from the term, you know, for a while. It's not really a term that I necessarily associate myself with, but I believe that it's speaking up for a cause, whatever that cause is, and making it known in public that you're speaking out for that cause. I consider myself more of an educator. You know, a lot of people stereotype activism as you have to be out there, you know, with a sign at a protest or getting, you know, doing an open rescue and, you know, maybe, you know, getting in trouble with the law for it. But honestly, at the end of the day, being an activist is really using your voice for a cause. And I feel like that's something that a lot of people are doing, and they need to take on the mantle of being an activist.
Yeah, for sure. And that's exactly what, like, the message that I'm trying to promote with this podcast, about how there's definitely no one-size-fits-all approach to activism. And I think what you're doing is very much just as powerful and effective as going on the streets or, like, what other people may view as the most dominant form of activism.
Absolutely. And I do those things, too. I protest as well, but I think that there can be a balance of just doing multiple different approaches.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. So I guess finally, you've mentioned quite a few documentaries and Instagram accounts that you've learned a lot from. So what are some resources that you would recommend to anyone who wants to learn more about the things that you've discussed during this conversation? How can people continue to, like, incorporate these ideas into their own activism?
Absolutely. Well, I've been reading AFCO. I'm actually on my second read of her and her sister Silco's book, Afroism. It's like essays in pop culture and veganism. And I highly recommend that anybody who's interested in how Black liberation ties in with animal liberation and just more in-depth information about interconnected oppression, that they read that book. She has another book called Racism as Zoological Witchcraft. There's also a podcast that I love called The Vegan Vanguard. They talk a lot about interconnected oppression. I also recommend following Sista Vegan on Instagram. She is an acclaimed you know, vegan writer and author and scholar. I also recommend reading By Any Greens Necessary by Tracy McWhorter and following By Any Greens on Instagram. Some other people that I recommend are Jake Conroy of The Cranky Vegan. He's an activist that was actually in prison for 2 years for the SHOT campaign. So those are a couple people that I think would be really great. And also the Agriculture Fairness Alliance, along with the Vegan Justice League.
Yeah, I will add all of those into the show notes of this podcast episode so that people can find them.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Everyday Activist podcast. If you enjoyed it, please be sure to rate and review the show, because that makes a huge difference in helping me get the word of the podcast out.
Also, if you have learned anything from this podcast and want to support the show financially, I would be really grateful if you could leave a one-time or monthly coffee donation through the link in the show notes to support the continuation of this show.
Thank you again for listening, and I'll see you next Monday.